This is The Reason Interview. I'm Zach Weissmuller, filling in for Nick Gillespie. And today I'm speaking with Keone Rodriguez, founder of Samurai Wallet, a privacy tool that allowed users to anonymize their Bitcoin by mixing it with other Bitcoin. He's now facing 5 years in federal prison, and Samurai's former CTO, William Hill, is facing 4. We recorded this conversation 48 hours before Rodriguez was supposed to report for prison. This is The Reason Interview with Keone Rodriguez. Keone Rodriguez, thank you for talking with Reason.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on to talk.
Yeah. So we're speaking about 48 hours before you're set to report to federal prison to serve a 5-year sentence for conspiracy to operate an unlicensed money transmitting business, which you did plead guilty to. We're going to talk about why you did that and why a guilty plea isn't actually as indicative of real guilt as it might seem in today's legal system. But first, I do want to acquaint everyone with the essentials of the case. You launched a product called Samurai Wallet about 10 years ago. What is it and why did you create it?
Sure. Yeah. So Samurai Wallet is what we would call a non-custodial Bitcoin wallet. Non-custodial only means that the user of the wallet or the software is the one that maintains total, complete control of their private keys or of their Bitcoin, as opposed to custodial, which is like a relationship that you have with your bank, right? You go walk into the bank, you give them $100. That $100 is yours, but the bank is the one who's holding it for you. So we built a non-custodial open source piece of software, a Bitcoin wallet named Samurai Wallet. And the reason we did that, primarily when I got involved in Bitcoin in 2012, I got involved because I saw Bitcoin as a digital analog to physical cash, a type of censorship-resistant currency where there was no third party between you and what you were trying to transact with or to. And by 2015, the culture in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies in general started to shift. It started to be more about an investment or an asset, a way to make a lot of money. And that's really not why I was here or my partner Bill was here. So we, instead of, you know, leaving the space or going to a different coin, we said, let's build the software that we want to see. Let's build the software that makes Bitcoin what we believe it can be. And if you have a censorship resistant form of currency, you really need to have privacy built in, mm-hmm. right? And what most people don't understand about Bitcoin is that it's actually very transparent. There isn't privacy built into the protocol of Bitcoin. If you have a web browser, you can log on to a website and see every single transaction that's ever occurred. And it's there permanently forever. That's not a great aspect of censorship resistance. So we needed to build software that could increase the privacy proposition for users so that Bitcoin could live up to its potential of censorship resistance.
Yeah. So you are trying to bring Bitcoin back, or we're trying to bring Bitcoin back to its kind of cypherpunk roots of a truly uncensorable private digital currency. And the way you did this with Samurai was, so just to back up, the way that most people buy Bitcoin is they go to an exchange like Coinbase, they connect their bank account to it, they buy the Bitcoin using their bank account, and then they can spend the Bitcoin or they can hold on to it, they can transact with other people. And there's this digital trail that you're talking about, the public ledger, that ultimately can be traced back to a real life right. person who used the bank account to get into Bitcoin. How did Samurai Wallet sort of disrupt that flow or make it less easy to trace back to that original on-ramp?
Yeah, that's an excellent way of framing it, right? So I, the way I like to describe to a lay person the type of privacy proposition that Samurai provided, again, imagine you walk to an ATM at your bank and you withdraw $100 out of the ATM. The bank knows you had $100 and the bank knows that you took out $100 in cash from the ATM, but the bank doesn't know what you do with that $100 after. They don't know where you spend it or where you send it to. And frankly, it's none of their business. What Samurai Wallet did was create that same level of financial privacy, right? So they go to an exchange, they buy $100 worth of Bitcoin from Coinbase. Coinbase knows who they are. Coinbase knows where they sent the $100 worth of Bitcoin to. But once they use Samurai Wallet, Coinbase could no longer see what they were spending their Bitcoin on, mm-hmm. that what they were spending that $100 worth of Bitcoin on. And again, it's none of Coinbase's business, right? That relationship is now done. Once you've taken the Bitcoin off of Coinbase's exchange into your own custody, into your own possession, it's nobody's business what you do with it afterwards. So we built the tool that essentially gave the basic level of financial privacy to a digital asset like Bitcoin. Yeah.
And so back in 2022, I spoke to someone from Samurai Wallet at the Miami Bitcoin conference who was wearing a face mask and sunglasses to preserve an anonymity. I think I can deduce at this point that that might have been you, but and it's understandable in retrospect why that anonymity was important. And that person told me compared Samurai Wallet to smelting gold. And I thought that was a really useful analogy. I was wondering if you could lay out that analogy, because it's a good way, I think, to understand the way that the Bitcoin goes into Samurai Wallet and then comes out untraceable.
Yeah. So I think I described it as, like you said, a gold smelter, where you and other people who want to get the same level of financial privacy all put in gold to the smelter. And in the smelter, all gold is equal and it comes out as gold. You don't lose any of it. It's the exact same gold. It's just been reformulated and recast into new ingots. So you start with a scratched up and dirty gold ingot. It gets melted down and recast into a brand new, fresh, clean ingot. Even that description isn't sufficient, to be honest with you, because what's actually happening in Samurai Wallet's Whirlpool functionality, which is what you would call the smelter, the person isn't actually getting rid of their Bitcoin. They're not actually ever sending their Bitcoin into a smelter. The Bitcoin is in their wallet at an address that they control, and it's just being moved to another address that they control in their wallet. So they never lose the Bitcoin in any way. And that's exactly why we thought we were on the right side of the law, is that the user is always in total, complete control of their Bitcoin. No one else is.
Right. So, and that's in contrast to, there are other services like this. They call them coin joins. And in other cases, it might be that there is some central party that owns the quote unquote smelter that everyone's throwing the Bitcoin into. But right. In this case, it's really just a program to sort of connect all these different users and then almost automate the smelting process, if we stick with that analogy. Is that more or less a proper way to think about it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. So the traditional mixer, you would call it, worked exactly as you described. I had Bitcoin and I wanted to get some sort of privacy. I had to send that Bitcoin to the mixer, and then the mixer would send other unrelated Bitcoin back to me. Mm-hmm. That's called a custodial mixer, right? Because I, as the user, no longer have custody of my Bitcoin or control over it. I relinquish it to a third party. What we figured out was how to get the same outcome of privacy without the user having to relinquish any form of control to a third party. And I believe because we figured out how to do that and do it effectively, that incensed the government, right? Because they could go after a custodial mixer. That is money transmission.
Right.
It's plain and clear. But what we had the audacity to do was figure out a way to get privacy in the same manner without crossing the lines that the government set. They said no custody. We figured out a way to do it without custody. And because we did that, I think they really, they were really unhappy with us, clearly.
Yeah. And perhaps I want to set an example. And I want that, great. I wanted everyone to understand that central fact, because it's crucial to your case that Samurai never had custody of any of this money. And that's an important fact to consider when you're looking at the crime that you pled to, which was running an unlicensed money transmitting business. So this was not like a bank or a Western Union where you're collecting money from one person and then sending it to another. When we're thinking about whether or not you should be pardoned, why is that a particularly important consideration?
Yeah, I mean, it is the major consideration, right? So the regulatory agency in charge of illicit finance and money transmission is called FinCEN. The Financial Crime Enforcement Network. It's a Department of the Treasury offshoot. And their whole remit is to stop illicit finance and to regulate money transmission. And in 2013, they wrote, really, for a regulatory agency, very common sense guidance. They said, in order to be a money transmitter, you have to take custody of the money, right? Because how can you transmit something that you don't have? So it was very clear, 2013. In 2019, they reiterated their previous guidance. You have to have custody and control of the money if you're a money transmitter.
And just to, just to keep the timeline straight here. So that was 2013 that guidance went out. You launched Samurai Wallet around 2015?
Correct.
Okay. So you were operating under that good faith assumption that, okay, this is what the federal government says, so we're playing within these rules. Okay,
correct.
So continue then. 2019, they reiterated that, and then what happened?
Yeah, so they reiterate that, and they add additional language. They introduce this concept of what they called an anonymity service provider or an anonymity software provider. And they reiterate, they said, if the anonymity software provider does not take custody of the funds, they are not a money transmitter. And they were very clear. It wasn't, you know, in some garbled regulatory language. It was just as I said, very clear. After that guidance came out, we launched Whirlpool, which was our CoinJoin implementation. Because what is Whirlpool if not an anonymity software provider? So we thought we were good, right? We don't take custody. We're not a money transmitter. The government, of course, we know they charged me with unlicensed money transmission. But what most people don't know is 6 months before the government brought the indictment, they actually went to FinCEN, and the government asked FinCEN, is Samurai Wallet an unlicensed money transmitter? And FinCEN responded to the government in writing, in black and white, no, they don't take custody of the funds. We wouldn't consider them a money transmitter. The government had this information 6 months before indicting us, and then they indicted us anyway, with one of the charges being unlicensed money transmission, even though the regulatory agency in charge of issuing license had just told them they wouldn't consider us to be a money transmitter.
Yeah, I pulled that communication because it was just so stunning to see it in black and white. I'm going to pull that up so the audience can see, our video audience. I'll read it for our audio listeners. So this is communication between the Department of Justice prosecutors who prosecuted your case and FinCEN, this regulatory agency that's in charge of regulating money transmitters. And what they say here is that because Samurai does not take custody of the cryptocurrency by possessing the private keys to any addresses where the cryptocurrency is stored, that would strongly suggest that Samurai is not, emphasis in the original, acting as an MSB, but which I guess is their acronym for a money transmission business. So you're saying that this only came forth 6 months into you being prosecuted. How did that delay in this pretty crucial concession affect your legal defense?
So actually, it was a year. We didn't find out about this for a year into the case, right? So they had this information 6 months before indictment, and they hid it from us, right? There's a rule in criminal proceedings that the government has to hand over all evidence against the defendant, whether that evidence is good or bad. And good evidence for the defendant is called exculpatory evidence. And they have an obligation under Brady to provide that exculpatory information without us asking. Thank God my lawyer asked, He asks a year into this case, have you ever had any conversations with FinCEN? And the government responds, yeah, of course, we did. Here it is. So it was shocking. It was a bombshell to us that this information was out there. And they still proceeded to indict us on this particular charge. What that suggested to us is during the indictment phase, where if your listeners don't know, a defendant isn't a part of the indictment. It's the prosecutor and a grand jury and the judge. And the prosecutor is, you know, on the honor system, producing all the evidence related to the alleged crimes. I think the fact that a grand jury indicted us on unlicensed money transmission strongly suggests that the prosecutor did not produce to the grand jury the letter from FinCEN. Because what jury would indict on unlicensed money transmission when the regulator in charge of money transmission says in black and white, we don't think he's a money transmitter? Yeah. So it was a bombshell to us. And we thought that, you know, even though the government shouldn't have withheld this information and would have saved us a lot of money had they produced this information when they were supposed to, we felt we had a good shot in front of the judge in you know, arguing that one, there was a Brady violation, and two, that these charges should be dismissed. These are not charges that can stand as a matter of law.
Yeah. So when, obviously that's something that I assume will be challenged on an appeal and is also a basis for your claim that you should be pardoned and not serve any time. I want to go through some of the government's arguments and have you respond directly to them. I read the indictment, and the government points out that Samurai, while you didn't have custody of the funds, you had centralized servers that were running the pools that, you know, basically like validate the transactions and kind of create this layer of obfuscation and generating new Bitcoin addresses. Does that not make you culpable?
Well, it's technically wrong. And so here's the thing about indictments that most people, again, don't really realize. Indictments are government fan fiction. Okay, they can say whatever they want in these indictments. They can stretch the truth, they can take things out of context, and they can be downright wrong, right? Mm-hmm. So as you just said, the government claims technically that our centralized servers were the ones creating these addresses. Even if we didn't have the private keys, the centralized servers were the ones generating the addresses for users. That's absolutely incorrect and can be verified because the code is out there in open source. And you can look at the code, point them directly to it, and say, that's not true. So if the government is so wrong about things that can so easily be fact checked in this indictment, they're probably stretching the truth on things that can't be easily fact checked, like a tweet that I made or what I meant by this saying this word. So government indictments have nothing to do with truth. The government has a story, and the indictment is their opportunity to paint the picture in the way they want it to be painted. So lots of things are taken out of context, and lots of things are just frankly wrong.
Yeah. You know, there's something. Bitcoin was started by this pseudonymous creator, Satoshi Nakamoto. Nobody knows who it is to this day. There's theories about it. It's every single day it becomes more clear why it was done in that way, why the pseudonymity was undertaken from the get-go. Is it ultimately that these processes are going to have to be sustainable, that they are going to have to be completely decentralized where there's no individual to connect to any of the software?
I mean, it appears to be that way, right? We operated Samurai Wallet openly and notoriously because we thought it was so clear that we are on the right side of the law. Right. Mm-hmm. We weren't doing anything wrong. We were following the guidance. That was, I guess, some level of naivete, that the government will follow their own rules. Now it's very clear that it doesn't matter. If you're in their targets, they'll figure out a way to take you down. So yes, unfortunately, I think it is the case that future tools, even if they are clearly and unambiguously within the realm of the law, need to take adequate protection against a government that will go after them if they don't like the tool. And to your point about decentralization, we were in fact 4 months away at the time of raid, FBI raid, of decentralizing that aspect of Whirlpool, right? We were very, very close where we did have a central server. The central server wasn't doing anything but passing messages between clients. And the messages couldn't even be read by the server. They were blinded, we call it. And we were very close to taking that one central server that we operated and distributing it across thousands of users to be operated. Unfortunately, we just ran out of time.
Yeah. Do you think that there's still a certain inevitability to that? Do you think that will still happen? I noticed that the code for Samurai is still active. You can still go on GitHub and get it, and you've licensed it as open source, so anyone can take it and, I guess, modify it as they want. Do you expect that tools like Samurai will survive in the long run?
Yes, yes, absolutely. It wasn't long. It was maybe a few weeks after our arrest that some anonymous coders forked what we call forked Samurai Wallet, made a copy of Samurai Wallet, and are running it themselves. They've even reintroduced Whirlpool and are running that themselves. And they're doing it in a way that is, more protecting of those developers. They're only going through Tor. They don't have a social media presence. They don't have a ClearNet domain. They've been driven underground, which was the whole point of this operation, to drive the innovators underground. And unfortunate, that's very unfortunate for America. But there is just an innate demand for privacy. People do want privacy. People don't want corporations and governments knowing every detail about their lives. So this type of software will always be there. You just may have to look a little harder for it.
And that follows a pattern that we've seen before where Ross Ulbricht went to prison for starting the Silk Road, and yet online black market, dark web marketplaces are more numerous than ever before. They still exist. So taking down Ross Ulbricht and the Silk Road did not end that phenomenon.
No, it blew up in their face, in fact, because on the Silk Road, there were a lot of rules, right? There were no weapons allowed, and there was no, child stuff allowed, and it was drugs, right? And there was a code of honor that these people, lived by. When they took that down, it opened the door for all sorts of replacements that didn't have those same code of ethics, and you could get some truly diabolical stuff. So it was a backfire on the government's part. It's like trying to take down a Hydra.
So why did you plead guilty if you believe to this day that you weren't actually running a money transmitting business?
So trying to go face to face with the Department of Justice as a individual person versus a monolithic agency that has unlimited resources, it's tough. But there was one event that really solidified the decision in my mind. So I had mentioned we had found out about the FinCEN letter. We had found out that the government had hid exculpatory evidence against for us. So we wrote a motion to the judge to discuss this, to say, hey, judge, some bad behavior has happened here, and we want more information. We want to know what else they talked about, and we want some sort of sanctions on the government for their actions here, which were illegal. You can't withhold evidence. We also wrote a really compelling motion to dismiss indictment. And in the motion to dismiss the indictment, it's really unique because you have to assume that everything the government has said about you in their indictment is true, because it's not the time to argue facts, right? So assuming everything the government said about you is true, the indictment should be dismissed anyway, and here's a bunch of legal reasons why. We put together a phenomenal one. I'll just make two highlights from our motion to dismiss, but I recommend anyone who's interested read it because it's great legal work. In 1940, there was a Supreme Court case against a gentleman named Falcone. And Falcone was being charged with a conspiracy charge, just like we are, of distributing sugar to a bootlegger in the creation of illicit alcohol. This is during Prohibition. And they got him on this conspiracy charge because he knowingly sold sugar to a bootlegger. And the Supreme Court overturned it. They said, you can't be a part of a conspiracy unless you're actually a part of the crime. Just mere knowledge of the crime isn't enough to be a member of the conspiracy. It's a major, major case that really feeds into what we are kind of being charged with, right? Just because we knew that criminals could use our software is not enough to join their conspiracy. We needed to know the exact crime and be materially a part of it. The second one I think is also very interesting and a lot of parallels is a 1990s case where a distributor of grow lights that are used in horticulture was taken down on a conspiracy charge because he knowingly sold his grow lights to a marijuana cultivator. And he had even advertised his grow lights in High Times magazine, right? Which is a magazine directed towards marijuana enthusiasts. And he even joked when he sold the grow lights to the cultivator and he joked and said, I don't want to know what you're going to do with these grow lights, right? Government came down on him on a conspiracy charge again. They got their conviction and that conviction was overturned. Again, it's not enough. Even advertising generally to something that might be illegal is not enough to join the conspiracy. Yeah. So these are hardcore Supreme Court level precedents, legal precedents that we thought was very compelling. So we put this into our motion to dismiss. So we had a motion to dismiss. We had a motion to about the Brady violation. We had a simple motion asking the judge to allow what are called amicus briefs. Amicus briefs are submissions to the court to help educate the judge on a complex topic, right? What could be more complex than the intricacies of Bitcoin? This is a 79-year-old judge. She's probably never heard of it, or he was a 79-year-old judge, probably never heard of Bitcoin before. Here's some information to help you understand this case. So these are the motions that we have before the court. Very important time. Suddenly, 2 or 3 days before we're supposed to argue these motions in front of the judge, our judge changes, which is unusual, right? Normally, you get a judge at the beginning of your case and you see that judge throughout the entirety of your case. It can happen for real extreme sickness or something like that, but that wasn't the case here. Our previous judge was fine and still seeing other cases. So we have a brand new judge. That's kind of a red flag, kind of weird. The judge that we get reassigned to, let's just say she has a reputation. She was not only a former prosecutor, she was the former top prosecutor in the SDNY. She was the former head of the criminal division in the SDNY where I'm being tried.
Denise Cote is her name, former U.S. assistant attorney in SDNY, which, that's one of the, known as one of the toughest jurisdictions for financial crimes. Former prosecutor.
High level prosecutor, right? So you have a top prosecutor who's now a judge, and she has a reputation for being a very harsh sentencer. You know, if she can give the max, she's giving the max. If you go to trial and you don't take a deal, you're not getting any leniency. It's called the trial penalty. You're getting the full 25 years in my case. So these were concerning, you know, developments.
You don't want to take those odds, basically.
Right. Again, now you're starting to shift your understanding of this process and go, okay, well, this isn't great, but we haven't met her yet. We haven't appeared in front of her yet. You know, we have a very compelling motion. We have a definite Brady violation. Let's see what she has to say. So we go to court, our first time appearing in front of Judge Cote. We're there to argue these motions. She gets onto the bench. She sits down. She says, I've read your motions. They're all denied. And that was the end of it. There was no argument. There was no trying to convince the judge of the merits of our motions. There was the fact that the government had withheld evidence wasn't even in contention. But it was denied. And the amicus briefs, which are something that are routinely approved throughout courts all over the country because judges aren't experts at everything, right? They need guidance and help. That was also denied. So at that point, and actually there was even no written or verbal opinion as to why she denied the motions. So we have no understanding as to what her thought process is. We have nothing to even appeal. Because she didn't say, she didn't say or write what her thought process was. So at that point, I was like, okay, we're going to get railroaded here.
Under those circumstances, you're not going to go to trial if that's how things are going to be handled. And already we know that federal prosecutions are well over 90% successful.
98.
Pleading guilty under those circumstances, not necessarily, someone not involved in the legal system might not want to take that as an actual admission of guilt.
This
question at the center of just providing a tool to somebody who can use that tool for criminal activities, and you know, in some sense that criminals probably will use this tool, just like the manufacturer of a gun or even a knife knows that some percentage of people are going to use this for something bad, something they shouldn't use it for. That's really the question that's kind of at the center of this case. And I want to present a couple of the government's arguments to you along those lines, because the indictment accuses you of facilitating about $237 million of criminal activity. That's a big number. It points to money that flowed from places like the Silk Road, which we know closed down before Samurai Wallet even existed, but there was this Bitcoin, once the site was seized, there was a bunch of Bitcoin that just sat. Nobody wanted to move it because they knew people were watching. But once Samurai came into existence, some of that money started to move into Samurai wallets and was presumably mixed. What do you say to the accusation that things like this make you a de facto money launderer?
Well, there's two things about it. One is we can't examine the way the government came to that conclusion, right? Mm-hmm. So how the government came to the conclusion that one, there's $237 million. Two, it came from the Silk Road. You know, the way they come to these conclusions that we've seen in other trials are by consulting with a chain analysis company, which the methodology that they use to come to these conclusions are a black box, and you can't examine the heuristics and the error rate of their claims.
A chain analysis company, for people who don't know, they're like detectives who trace back the transactions and try to find the origin point. Yeah,
correct. That's absolutely correct. And there was a case recently, a defendant named Roman Sterlingov, who they claim is the operator of one of these old custodial mixers. And when the defense tried to cross-examine the chain analysis company as to how they, what methodology they used to come to these conclusions, the government successfully suppressed that and said, this is a national security concern. We can't tell you. So you don't really even have the ability to confront your accusers when they bring out the magic words of national security. So that's the one side of the answer, is we can't even know if they're telling the truth or the veracity of these claims. But the other side of the answer is it doesn't matter, right? Maybe it did. Maybe $237 million worth of crime went through the software I built. It's quite possible. It wouldn't surprise me. People who, are criminals do demand privacy, just in the same way that people who are completely legitimate, upstanding citizens require privacy. It's privacy is for everyone. So it doesn't surprise me at all. What you won't find in the indictment, however, is any conversation between me or Bill with a criminal. Right. Mm-hmm. Saying, hey, use this software. It will hide your funds. It will launder for you, because that didn't exist. We didn't know at the time that these Silk Road coins were coming through Whirlpool. Had no idea. But it doesn't, I'm not an idiot, right? Criminals will use software.
Yeah.
Terrorists will use Signal. They will use VPNs. They will use Tor. Mm-hmm. They will use software. So the government's whole theory of this basically hinges on the fact that as that Samurai Wallet was a financial institution, right? That's how they framed it. Samurai Wallet is a financial institution. And as a financial institution, we have the obligation to perform anti-money laundering checks and KYC checks. And because we didn't do that, that was the object of conspiracy. That's why we created a software that was only intended to attract crime. Because if we had implemented those functionalities, then these criminals wouldn't have used our tool. But the whole premise is flawed because no one has ever said that a piece of software is a financial institution. You can't be a financial institution if you don't take anyone's money. We don't take anyone's finances.
Yeah. And just to give an example of how far that logic can be pushed, we've seen examples of this in Europe as it pertains to speech, where the founder of Telegram was arrested in France because terrorists allegedly use Telegram to communicate with each other, or would-be terrorists. Therefore, Telegram, I believe France, they actually accused them of operating an unlicensed encrypted communication service. So this is expanding from you can't transact anonymously to you can't speak anonymously. So this is kind of like where this could be headed, just something for people to keep in mind. But I do want to really press a little bit further on the question of whether you were encouraging criminals to use that, because that's what they're accusing you of. You say you didn't go and message criminals and say, hey, here's a way that you can fund your terrorist cell. And I've read the indictment, and that certainly is not in there as evidence. But what they do say is that you were kind of advertising this for criminals. And one example that they gave was when the EU sanctioned Russia, you tweeted from the official Samurai account, "Welcome new Russian oligarch Samurai users." And when there was a Bitcoin scam on Twitter, you allegedly solicited scammers to try out Samurai to clean the money, which they didn't. Why did you market this way, and did it ultimately doom you?
Okay, good question. I'll answer the second part first. Did it ultimately doom us? No, it didn't. Okay. And we know this because there is a case going on in the Southern District of New York at the same time as our case. It's U.S. versus Roman Storm, who created Tornado Cash. And Tornado Cash, a similar story, doesn't take custody, is primarily for Ethereum, not Bitcoin. And Roman, who is a Russian American citizen, never made a tweet like that, never advertised like that, was clean cut, no jokes, just a software developer. And they came down on him just as hard as they came down on me. So the tweets, that wasn't the reason. The government saw that tweet. They saw, oh, Russian oligarchs. He's inviting Russian oligarchs. Oh, that's great. And they were very happy about that tweet because they can bring that in front of the judge and the grand jury and say, look, he's advertising to our enemies, the Russian boogeyman. But let's look at this a little bit clearer, right? Okay. As I said earlier, the indictment is government fan fiction. They'll take something and completely twist it out of context. They will show you one word out of a 1500 word document if that word works for them. Russian oligarchs. This is something I said publicly in English on Twitter. Okay. Welcome new Samurai wallet, Russian oligarch Samurai wallet users. If you go to the Samurai wallet Twitter page and search the term welcome new, you will find 15 different welcome new tweets. When the Federal Reserve of this country made it against their regulations for employees to trade Bitcoin, I retweeted that and said, welcome new Federal Reserve Samurai wallet users. When Japan made a capital gains tax of 100% on Bitcoin in that country, I tweeted that, welcome new Japanese Samurai wallet users. So it was what we would call a meme, a joke. Yeah. You're not soliciting Russian oligarchs to use your platform. They're not using Bitcoin anyway. They're using property in Dubai and London. They're using jewelry. They're using art to launder their proceeds. They're not using Bitcoin. Yeah. So it was another
way to describe it, and I'm not sure if this is a legal term, might be shitpost. And
that's correct.
So this is like, a way to, so you're saying this is a way to kind of, it's just, a kind of modern marketing, putting out a message that's intentionally provocative. And obviously the government is going to use anything you say to their advantage to paint it as if you're inviting, but your contention is that this was not a serious outreach to the Russian oligarchic class.
No, I don't think the Russian oligarchs are perusing Twitter looking for ways to launder money.
Yeah. There's one other piece of marketing that's in the indictment that they zeroed in on that is interesting to look at because I think it reveals the difference between how you and the state view free exchange. You had this graphic asking who is willing to pay for privacy. And you highlight online gambling. And we know that that is true, but Bitcoin, there's huge Bitcoin exchanges related to online prediction markets and gambling. Restricted markets, which is the one I've highlighted here, and asset protection, which is really about just kind of the classic case of holding Bitcoin because you don't trust the dollar or whatnot. But on this case of restricted markets, they are zeroing in on that as, okay, well, there he is. He's saying people want that Samurai, a major component of Samurai is restricted markets, which is people using Bitcoin to buy things that they're not supposed to buy, to engage in illegal, to engage in criminal activity. What is your view of, and what did you mean by restricted markets here?
Yeah, sure. So first of all, this wasn't a advertised thing. This wasn't a public slide that we presented to people publicly. This was something when we were first starting Samurai Wallet. This was about 2015. We were presenting Samurai Wallet to a group of potential investors. We were trying to get some funding to build out Samurai Wallet. And there was a legitimate question by a lot of people was, one, can you monetize a free and open source Bitcoin wallet? You know, it seems kind of difficult. And two, who's going to pay for these types of functionalities? So this slide was breaking down generally who pays for privacy, right? And as you described it, you know, I can't see it now. But, oh, thank you. You have online gambling, you have asset protection, and then the one in the middle, the one the government really loves, is restricted markets. Restricted markets doesn't mean anything about legality. It doesn't mean illegal or legal. And it doesn't, you know, which restricted markets, right? It's restricted in China, perhaps to purchase and distribute religious material. It can be so many things. A medication that is completely legal in the United States, that's not legal in Europe. It can be anything. And, you know, I don't think I have any reason to make a value judgment or know what these people are up to and what they're transacting in. The reality of the situation, which is what this slide, this one slide out of, by the way, like 20 other slides, again, pulling one thing out of context, this one slide is just talking about the reality of the market. And they may not like it, but the largest market in the world is the black or gray market. It completely dwarfs the white market. And that is just the reality. So that's what we were trying to explain to the group of private investors who were considering investing in Samurai Wallet.
Yeah. So it highlights really an important disconnect, which is that the U.S. government views the existence of any restricted market as inherently bad, as something that needs to be squashed, I guess. And you think that there can be a valid reason for restricted markets to exist. You gave one example in China. You know, you could think of extreme examples in North Korea. Not that they have Bitcoin, but they've got, you know, there's smuggled goods for people there. And, you know, a disturbing theme of this case to me is the extent to which the American government today treats the entire concept of privacy as de facto illegal, especially when it comes to money. It's like, because software exists that enables anonymization and some criminals will use that, the entire concept of privacy is poisonous and illegal. And it creates a cloud of suspicion over anyone who even talks about privacy. Cause it's like, what are you trying to hide? But when I talked to you back in 2022, it was on the heels of the Canadian trucker protest, which I view as a great case study for Bitcoin. What happened, to refresh everyone's memory, is that you know, the truckers were basically shutting down the capital of Canada because they were upset about vaccine mandates crossing over and back into the US and back into Canada. And people were trying to donate to them to support. And the Canadian government didn't like that. And they systematically went and started shutting down bank accounts that were that showed any evidence of money flowing to the truckers. The only thing that ended up getting through in the end, and I produced a little documentary about this, was Bitcoin. But the way that they were able to do it was a couple of guys came up with this idea of essentially writing down the codes on what's called a paper wallet and going over the border and just handing them out to the truckers. That's a very grassroots, low-tech way of getting around the problem. And you're trying to, you know, bootstrap a little bit of a more sophisticated way of doing things like that. That's an example that always comes to mind to me of, okay, well, that seems like a valid use of privacy. If the government's literally preventing you from donating to a cause you believe in. But what would your defense of the concept of spending money anonymously and privately sound like?
I don't even know if I have to defend it. It's the de facto state of being for almost all of our history. You know, there was never been another time other than the last several decades where the government or corporations could just peer into your finances on a transactional granular level. It's completely new, right? So I think they should have to defend that to us, not us have to defend private transactions to them. We have had private transactions almost all of our history since the creation of money, right? Whether it was gold, silver, even fiat, right? When you have dollar bills in your pocket, no one knows where those dollar bills came from or where they're going. Only you and the person you're transacting to. That has been the de facto state of things. Now the government wants to know every single thing you're doing. They want to know where you're spending. They want to make sure you're paying your taxes appropriately. They want to see every aspect of your financial life, because transacting and donating and spending money, that is speech. There's no greater form of speech than transacting. You just described it with the Canadian truckers. What better form of speech is there than me donating my resources to a cause that I deeply care about? That's speech. And the government wants and always tries to crack down on speech. And the new innovation of money and transactions being, you know, permissioned by the government, it is new. It's brand new, last several decades. And, you know, I don't even know if I have to defend it. I think they have to defend their interpretation to us.
Yeah. And I believe you've said before that one thing that drew you to Bitcoin in the first place was WikiLeaks, because they've, for obvious reasons, they've had fundraising troubles. Is that true, that WikiLeaks was one example of the value of private money for you?
Yeah, WikiLeaks was a major one, right? Because the government didn't even need to step in and say, oh, you can't donate to WikiLeaks. Visa and MasterCard, these giant, you know, mega corporations, they're the ones that did the heavy lifting. Yeah. They're the ones that said, you can't donate to WikiLeaks. That's insane. It's my money. I want to donate to the causes I believe in. And I have some corporation telling me I can't do it. That was one of the big turning points of Bitcoin. People understood innately what it means to have a third party between you and the person you're transacting with. And with Bitcoin, there was no third party. No one could stop you from donating to WikiLeaks. And so that was a major, major thing for me. Yeah. My family, my father's side of the family comes from Cuba. They left before, right after the revolution. His family owned a beverage factory, and they were some of the first people to have their factory seized because Castro was seizing the means of production. So they left Cuba with nothing on their, you know, and they came to the United States. But I'm just thinking of this now because we're talking about restricted markets. Just getting meat in Cuba is a restricted market, right? That's against the law to get above your allocation of meat for the month. And there's a thriving gray market. There's a thriving black market of people trading for protein, right? So, you know, the government highlighting restricted markets as some sort of, illusion of criminality, when we're talking about stuff that can be criminalized being literally protein, you know? So, right.
And if people think that, you know, by us talking about authoritarian communist regimes, that this is something that cannot happen here, I just implore you to think about the, recall the COVID era and ask yourself, really, do you think that these levers like cannot be pulled and that people, there are not people itching to pull those levers? We're seeing, we saw kind of a glimpse of that. When you're considering this case, I just ask you to really think about that and think about the plausibility of all this. It used to be a kind of fringe or crazy seeming thing for people to talk about. But at this point, I think you're kind of in denial if you don't see the possibilities there. Your last hope here might be Donald Trump. He surprised a lot of us by following through on his promise to free Ross Ulbricht. And incredibly, he's now acknowledged your case after a journalist from Decrypt News asked him directly at a press conference. Let's listen to that.
Mr. President, this week, a man named Keone Rodriguez is going to federal prison for creating crypto privacy software. The case was started under the Biden administration, but your DOJ kept it going and secured the conviction. A lot of people in crypto are saying that this man should be pardoned. Are you familiar with the case at all, or would you be interested?
I've heard about it. I'll look at it. Why, you think he should be pardoned? Sounds like it. Sounds like, based on your question.
Many people in the
Rodriguez, we'll look at that, Bam. Okay, let's take a look at it. You know, you'll have to tell me. I don't know anything about it, but we'll take a look.
So there he is telling Pam Bondi, his AG, to take a look at it. What was your reaction to that?
I mean, what a surreal moment. You know, to hear the president of the United States talking about you individually and the software that you spent 10 years building, very surreal. It was not expected at all. But I think it's a good development for us. I've long said that the biggest stumbling block for me and Bill in getting a pardon is getting the attention of the president. You know, everyone is vying for his attention, a lot of money, a lot of influence, a lot of power is going after the president to get him to know about their pet issue. And we don't have money, influence, or power. We're just two software developers. So that was, I think, the biggest stumbling block, getting his attention. And you know, thankfully, a reporter at Decrypt brought the case to his attention for us. Uniquely, I think it is absolutely uniquely, the president of the United States has been intimately aware with a weaponized Department of Justice, right? Love the guy, hate the guy, has nothing to do with it. The DOJ came down on President Trump hard. They raided his house in Mar-a-Lago. They, you know, attacked him. They have attacked his family and they've tried to incarcerate him. That is so helpful to people like me and Bill who have also been targeted by a weaponized Department of Justice, because we have someone in the highest office in the land who knows what that looks like, who can see the tricks that DOJ has pulled, the hiding of evidence, the distortion of facts, taking tweets out of context. You know, this is a president who knows intimately what that looks like. And it truly is, I think, helpful for us, because if he does indeed look at the details of this case, he will be essentially seeing a deja vu moment. He will be saying, I've seen this before. And oh, by the way, it's the same group of people. It's the same Southern District of New York who've come after me and my family. So I think, you know, the fact that it's got to his attention is very helpful for us. And I think the president does want to do right by the crypto community. He said as much in his campaign season.
Yes.
And if he wants America to be the capital of crypto, the one way to make sure that comes about is to end prosecuting its software developers, end prosecuting its innovators, because that innovation will just go offshore. That innovation will go somewhere where software developers aren't at risk of being sent to federal prison. So he can do a lot, I think, at this point with a pardon, and I hope that he will.
Yeah, President Trump likes to make a statement when he does things like this. He did that with Ross Ulbricht. He was very vocal about this weaponization of justice that you've brought up. And he certainly could make a similar statement in this case if he were to act. Right, and yes, you mentioned William Hill, who is was the CTO of Samurai and is facing 4 years in federal prison. So the hope would be that the pardon would be for both of you. We're speaking about 48 hours before you're set to report to federal prison to serve your 5-year sentence. It's not often most of us speak directly to someone in this situation. What's it like just on a personal human level going through this?
It's heavy. Course, you know, you're leaving your family behind, you're leaving life behind. Last night I spoke with Ross Ulbricht. He gave me a call to give me some advice and see where my headspace is at. And, you know, he was facing a far worse fate than I was. He was facing double life sentence.
Yeah.
No possibility of parole. He was fully expecting to die in prison. I'm only looking at 5 years, right? But he said even a short sentence or short-ish sentence like 5 years, he put it in a way that's, he basically said, you essentially die a little bit on the outside, right? Because you're no longer around. You're gone. And the only people that are remembering you are maybe your family and close friends. But just like when someone in your family passes away, over time, the memory fades and you don't think about them every day. And it's kind of the same thing when you go inside. So I think I'm preparing for that. But most of all, it sounds very banal, but I'm taking care of a lot of small logistical things that I normally do in my relationship and in my life that now my wife is going to be responsible for. So I put together a document that says, how do you reset the printer when it won't print? How do you, you know, get the internet to work when it stops working? The little things that I take care of that she now is going to have to take care of, I want to make it as smooth of a transition for her as possible. I think, again, another thing that many people who have spoke to me, who have gone through this process have said is that doing time is harder on your loved ones than it is on you, right? You're there, you're in the space, you're dealing with it, but they're on the outside dealing with the world without you. Yeah. I'm conscious of that and I'm just trying to do everything I can to soften that blow for my wife.
Keone Rodriguez, I know every minute is especially precious for you these days, so thank you for taking the time to share your story with Reason.
Thank you for having me again. This, I think, is the third collaboration we've done with Reason, second video perhaps, but you guys have been wonderful. Thank you for getting the word out about this case from the day of the arrest and raid. Reason produced a video, you produced a video, and it's been so helpful in just giving people a bird's eye view of what this case is about and what it actually means. So I have all my thanks for you guys.
Yeah, well, it's a case that really matters, both from a level of justice and injustice, and also these deeper questions of what kind of society do we want? What kind of level of privacy and freedom? And we need to reflect on that and really, I think, be respectful of the people who are pushing those questions forward. So thank you again, Keone.
Thanks.